This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
We've all probably become a little numb to hearing it being said, but with every summer now comes the oppressive, sometimes unbearable heat. We're feeling the start of it this year with a few days of sweltering temperatures in and around the Bay Area, some places hitting into the triple digits. And while this heat wave is a short-lived one, many are bracing for the next one, and the next, and the next. Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. So what will the warmer months hold for us in California and around the rest of the Western United States this year? And will the weather extremes we see, from floods to droughts to wildfires, become more frequent and worse as time goes by? To help us understand the here and now and what may come, we turn to Daniel Swain, climate scientist at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA and at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Daniel Swain, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation on In Depth.
Thanks for having me.
So here in the Bay Area and in other parts of California, we just experienced a little taste of a heat wave. So I kind of want to start there first. What sort of temperatures have we been seeing here in the start of summer for California and more broadly for the western part of the United States so far this year?
Well, this most recent heat wave, as many heat waves in California do, peaked much more strongly across inland areas. So it was in the well into the triple digits in the Central Valley. And it was not so warm along the immediate coast. Ocean Beach in San Francisco, of course, as is not uncommon for June heat waves, was still pretty chilly. But you get inland to the East Bay, San Francisco Bay Area, the Inland Empire in Southern California, and it was pretty toasty. But I think the more interesting heat was the heat we saw in places like the northern end of the Sacramento Valley and also up at higher elevations. So in the Sierra Nevada, places like South Lake Tahoe and Truckee and Reno, on the other side of the mountains, were essentially near record heat territory for early June. So this was a more anomalous event the further inland you go. And it is notable also because this heat wave is quite extensive across the West. So this is not localized to the interior of California, but is in fact extending all the way from central and northern Mexico, where a part of the country that has actually been experiencing record-shattering heat in recent weeks, just for sort of unceasing heat challenges now in Mexico City, for example, with the drinking water supply there, all the way up into western Canada. So this is a really big heat wave. It's not as hot as a major heat wave at peak season might be, say closer to the middle of summer in July or August. But for early June, especially as you get away from the coast, this has been a fairly remarkable heat event.
What does that mean for the rest of this summer? What are we going to see?
Well, you know, the rest of the summer, sometimes there's not a particularly strong indication one way or the other for how summer and fall might look from our current perspective in June. But this year, there's actually quite a strong signal that most of the Western U.S., including most of California, especially away from the immediate shoreline, it's likely to be much warmer even than the recent average. And of course, that recent average is already warmer than the 20th century average because of the long-term warming trend over that period. So in other words, there's a pretty high likelihood that the second half of the summer into the fall will be exceptionally hot across much of the West, much more so even than the first half of the summer in all likelihood. And this is coupled with the possibility that in the Southwest, but the summer monsoon, those thunderstorms that often occur in the desert regions and comprises a substantial amount of the annual precipitation in that part of the Southwest, may be pretty weak this year. So across the interior West, perhaps an exceptionally hot and dry summer, and then indications that this sort of expands even farther westward into California as we get from late summer into autumn. So potentially a particularly warm August through October period with perhaps a late start to the rainy season in California this year. That raises the question of whether our relatively mild early fire season this year so far in California is going to continue through the end of the season. And my personal prediction is that it won't, that we'll see a much more active second half to this fire season than we see in the first half. So hopefully we get to July at least without any major dangerous wildfires in California. But I think that the situation is likely to change not only across California, but across a lot of the West in the second half of summer into the autumn because of those super warm temperatures and unusually dry conditions, especially given that all of that was likely to follow what has been an unusually wet period. This past winter was wetter than average in most of California, and the previous winter was exceptionally wet. That's given us a bit of a fire season reprieve for the past couple of years because of the dampness. But now, as things warm up and dry out later this summer, what it's going to give us is increased vegetation loading, so extra grass and brush growth. Because of that really favorable growing period over the past couple of years, once that all dries out and once the temperatures heat up heading into autumn offshore wind season, that could be a bit of a nasty combination. So I think this season, wildfire-wise, both in California and in the broader West, is probably going to be a lot more active, especially in the latter half of the season into the fall, than it has been over the past couple of years, which have been, for the most part, mercifully quieter than a lot of years in the decade that preceded it.
You mentioned that, you know, even though we typically expect these hotter temperatures to be seen like July, August, that it is not completely normal to see temperatures like this now. Is that kind of a harbinger of what we might expect in summers to come?
Overall, yes, I think both of those suppositions are largely correct. I think that, you know, it does matter what time of year heat occurs. In the extreme example, of course, you could imagine seeing 100 degree temperatures in January would be truly exceptional given, you know, January in the Northern Hemisphere is the middle of winter. Of course, it's not January, it's June, but still, you know, June is still early in the summer heat season to be experiencing temperatures this hot across most of the West. And usually when we talk about record-breaking temperatures, often it's relative to the location and calendar date. In other words, how hot is it right now in a particular place relative to how hot it usually is at this time of year? And by that standard, it's definitely been much hotter than average, in some cases record hot for this time of year in many places across the interior of the West. The other thing that we've seen with this particular event that's characteristic of, I think, where we're headed in the future is that there's actually been even more anomalous and even record-breaking warmth in the overnight hours. So yes, there have been some locations that approached or exceeded their record high temperatures for the particular calendar date, but there have been far more places that have been exceeding their record warm minimum, which is seems like a bit of a contradiction in terms. It just means that the coolest overnight temperature achieved, it never got down very low, and so therefore was the warmest overnight temperature on record in many places for many consecutive days during this event. I bring that up for two reasons. One, we know in many places that the nights are warming faster than the days in a warming climate, and that might sound like it offers a bit of a reprieve, and it might take the edge off relative to the other alternative during the daytime. But the problem with this is that really warm overnight minimum temperatures, and the fact that they're warming faster than temperatures the rest of the time, that has major implications for two things that are really important. One is human health, because we don't have as much ability without active cooling. So unless you're running your air conditioner throughout the night, or you're fortunate to have air conditioning, which of course many places and many people in places like coastal California do not, because it's historically not been necessary very often, those warm overnight temperatures limit how much the body cools down. So each degree of warming in the overnight hours actually can have a disproportionate effect on human health, because you don't have that overnight recovery that you used to. Another place where this ends up being really important is when you have wildfires. The other challenge here is what we're seeing is these overnight minimum temperatures don't get as low as they used to during these summertime heat waves. The relative humidity in those overnight hours also doesn't fall as low as it used to. And so this is both now something that was for a while mainly anecdotal from firefighters and fire managers that I would talk to, but now is also documented in the scientific literature, that wildfires are remaining active in the overnight hours to a far greater extent than they used to in the American West, because those heat wave temperatures and that relative humidity in the overnight hours is not getting as low as it used to. So those overnight warm temperatures are in some ways just as important, if not more important, than those daytime high temperatures. And that's very much a signature of the warming we've seen over the past decades.
When we're talking about these increases, it's warmer at night and not cooling down. Fires are burning hotter and longer. The temperatures during the day get hotter sooner. People are always like, why is that happening? You know, I think most people recognize that climate change is a central point for many of these discussions. And that's a lot of what your work looks at, is those connections between the extremes that we are seeing and experiencing and where climate shifts are playing into that. Is that right?
That's right. And I do study the connection between extreme weather events and our warming climate. And the clearest connection between those two things tends to be for things like heat waves that are directly related to temperature. And so it probably won't be surprising to most folks to learn that virtually every severe heat wave now that occurs, and there are plenty of them occurring, it essentially has a discernible link to that human-caused warming over decades. So if the average temperature is getting warmer, the extreme temperatures are also getting warmer. And sometimes we assume that they're getting warmer at about the same rate, that your extreme heat days are getting warmer at about the same rate as the overall change in temperature. But sometimes that's actually not what's happening. One example of that we've already talked about, which is the fact that those overnight temperatures in many places are warming faster than the daytime maximums. But the other thing that's happening is that certain kinds of heat waves in many regions can be further amplified, especially when they co-occur with the kind of heat domes that we've been talking about, these persistent ones, because the longer they last and the more they dry out the soils, the more of that sun's energy goes into heating the air. And if that continues for days or weeks on end, you can see how even a couple of additional degrees of warming initially can turn into more than a couple of degrees of warming after a heat wave persists for multiple weeks. There's even some fairly complicated science looking into how water vapor in the atmosphere may be changing in ways that also amplify heat waves. In fact, that's actually something that likely occurred during the recent and in some places ongoing heat event across the American West. A late season atmospheric river storm dropped quite a bit of rain in Washington and the Pacific Northwest earlier this past week. And yet these places are now approaching record warmth immediately thereafter. And sometimes when you have extra moisture in the atmosphere immediately preceding a heat wave, and that extra moisture resulted in the formation of clouds and precipitation, that can release what's known as latent heat, which then becomes sensible heat, so called because we can literally feel it or sense it. So in other words, that energy in the atmosphere through evaporated water can be transformed into increasing temperatures after that water falls out of the atmosphere as precipitation, after that condensation occurs. So that too, in a warming climate, is increasing and can amplify the magnitude of heat waves. So there's a lot of science baked in there. I guess that's a bit of a pun that's appropriate, but the long and the short of it is that climate change is making heat waves more frequent and more intense virtually everywhere on Earth, and California is no exception.
In Depth will return after a moment.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's join, MIDI.com.
If you're just tuning in to In Depth, we are speaking with Daniel Swain, climate scientist with UCLA. Some of what you were speaking of there makes me think about, obviously, this has profound effects on the environment, not just for people, but for every aspect of the environment. And I've spoken with others who are looking at the ways various communities and cities are trying to address how they adapt to the world getting hotter and hotter. But at the end of the day, that can kind of feel a little bit like pushing a boulder up a mountain to figure out, you know, what we can do. So in that respect, with the work that you do, how can society respond to the changes that we're seeing?
Well, I think this is an important point because California is widely, and I think appropriately, viewed as a leader in climate mitigation. In other words, thinking about ways that we can live our lives so that we don't emit as much carbon, that the carbon, of course, being part of the greenhouse gases that cause global warming in the first place. So I think California has made great strides towards certainly flatlining and then reducing its statewide emissions that contribute to global warming in the first place. But there is another side to this. And I think that this is a place where California has is a little bit behind its mitigation activities, which is climate adaptation. The notion that the climate has already warmed and that there already are adverse consequences for the warming that we've already seen, and also that even in a very optimistic future, there will be a significant degree of additional warming and increase in extremes like heat waves and wildfires that we're going to have to deal with. And so the question there is, how can we stabilize and even improve our resilience to those kinds of extremes that, to be quite honest, were already something that we had to contend with before climate change, but certainly is something that we have to contend with to an even greater degree now than we used to. And it is somewhat location and hazard specific. Are we talking about, you know, downtown San Francisco or the foothills east of Fresno, or are we talking about Mount Shasta or downtown LA? Of course, these are very different places geographically, climatologically, and in terms of the people who live there and the potential exposures of the societies in these different places. So, you know, if we're talking about downtown San Francisco, wildfire is really not on the radar to the same extent as it would be in the Sierra Nevada foothills. Likewise, you know, the kinds of stresses you'd see in Southern California are different than Northern California. But when it comes to heat and wildfire specifically, you know, heat is mainly a problem right now because of the direct threat it poses to human health. It's actually one of essentially the deadliest weather event that occurs in the United States. And it's one that slips almost entirely under the radar because it's not perhaps as visually dramatic as a wildfire or a flash flood or a tornado or something. But extreme heat actually kills more people than any other weather event in North America. And it certainly aggravates illnesses that many thousands or even millions of other people have in addition to that. So thinking about how ways that we can adapt to extreme heat and reduce societal vulnerabilities to extreme heat are, you know, it, at an individual level to a societal level, it does vary from place to place, but ensuring that we build our cities in ways and adapt our cities in ways, since most of our cities already exist, that can accommodate the reality that we are seeing more extreme heat. This involves things, you know, at community scales, like increasing the number of green spaces or street trees. There's a pretty big effort toward moving in that direction in Los Angeles City and County, for example, right now. There's also things at individual level, like when people are remodeling or building structures, to build them in ways that they more readily shed heat in a passive way, or even, you know, in places where that's not possible, making sure that active cooling is available. You know, air conditioning has some negative externalities, but it's not the enemy. Sometimes you really do just want to be able to go into a nice, cool space that's consistently cool. And so ensuring equity in that kind of access to air conditioning is really important. We see that these days with things like community cooling centers that will open up. But the challenge there is that they're only open on the very hottest days of the year, and there's plenty of need on other days as well. So thinking about how we can build individual structures to accommodate these extreme heat loads and keep people cool, especially at night when it's most important, but also thinking about how we build neighborhoods or redevelop neighborhoods in ways that, you know, sort of allow those neighborhoods to be naturally cooler than if there's just tons of pavement and parking lots and asphalt. That can make a huge difference in urban areas from a heat perspective. Then from a wildfire perspective, in some ways, that's an even trickier problem in the sense that there are lots of different factors that are sort of aggravating the wildfire crisis in the American West and California, climate change being among them, and arguably, perhaps in some places, the most important one. Not always, not everywhere, but much of the time, it's a hugely important factor. And here, too, there's a question of, well, you know, the more climate change that doesn't happen, the less increase in extreme wildfires that we're going to see from that warming. But given that we live in the world that we live in, interventions like prescribed fire, these kinds of intentional, purposeful burns to improve ecosystem health and reduce the density of vegetation and fuel loading, and hopefully reduce the risk of wildfire catastrophes that follow. So this notion, increasingly prevalent in fire science and ecology and management circles, that, you know, fire itself is not the enemy. It's just that we don't want to be seeing these really big, bad, high-intensity, catastrophic conflagrations that impact communities and generate these smoke storms. But there is another path. The more prescribed burning we do, the less intense these fires that occur at other times will be, and the more manageable, hopefully, they'll become. And that's also a question of adapting communities once again. You know, how can we design communities so that they're more resilient to the wildfires that do occur, so that individual structures are not as flammable, so that evacuation routes are simpler and more readily available, things like that. And so it is a little bit context dependent. It kind of depends where you are and exactly what risk you're trying to mitigate. But it turns out there's a lot that can be done to adapt to these increasing extremes, because although we don't have total control over how much the planet warms, California, of course, can be a leader in carbon reduction, but ultimately can't solve that problem on its own. The adaptation side of things very much is something that can be successful and successfully implemented at a state level or even at a local level, because a lot of these interventions are things that communities can do themselves to benefit themselves.
From your perspective, where is climate science heading when we are talking about our world getting hotter every day? Where's climate science going now?
Well, that's an interesting question because, you know, from a really big picture perspective, the really big picture questions are largely settled in the sense that we know that the Earth is warming. We know that why it's warming, which is to say the accumulation of heat-trapping greenhouse gases due to human industrial and agricultural activities over the past century or so. But, you know, okay, great. You know, we know the climate change is real. We know why it's happening. That also means then that we essentially know what we need to do to stop it, which is stop emitting those same greenhouse gases that are causing the warming. But of course, that's easier said than done. And so in a certain sense, solving the big picture problem is not so much a climate science problem at this point, because we essentially know what we have to do to solve it. It's much more of a technological, or even really more a political problem, a socioeconomic challenge of how do we bend that carbon curve? How do we essentially transform our economies, our industry, our agricultural, our transportation, energy generation sectors to a new form that doesn't have all of the negative externalities of greenhouse gas emissions? So that has become more of a social and political question more than a physical science one. But, you know, that said, there are still really big, outstanding physical climate science questions. And we're still working diligently to resolve those. One is, you know, as we've been talking about, the exact degree to which climate change is going to increase some of these extreme events. You know, we've largely, at least in terms of the level of global warming to date, predictions made even decades ago have pretty much been correct as to how much warming we should have experienced to date. So those were at very broad scales. If you kind of squint at the globe, those really old predictions were actually really good and have borne out really well. Not that the outcome is good, but the predictions themselves were scientifically accurate. But the challenge is when you zoom in at regional scales, and also when you think about extreme events specifically, as opposed to just changes in average temperature or average precipitation, predictions have not necessarily been so good, and those processes are not always so well understood. And I think a good example of this is probably that the increase in wildfire severity in a lot of places like the Western US and Western Europe has outpaced predictions from a couple of decades back. Even though the overall warming level has been predicted correctly, the increase in wildfire activity has actually been a lot greater than predicted for that correctly predicted level of warming. And so then the question is, okay, why is this? And part of it is that climate change isn't the only factor at play. There are other things that have changed in the meantime, like the expansion of populated areas into high-risk zones and certain historical forest management policies that have facilitated that rapid rise. But we're also seeing something similar for things like extreme heat waves that have increased somewhat more than predicted in some regions, and also extreme precipitation events that have increased more than expected in some regions. And so one big question is, okay, if we got the level of warming correctly predicted, but we've underpredicted some of these increases in the extremes, what are we missing? And what does that imply for the risks that we'll face in the years to come? Even if we correctly predict the amount of warming that is yet to come, if we're underestimating the extreme events, then that's kind of a problem, because that's where a lot of the climate change impacts, the adverse consequences, actually arise from. So that's an interesting physical science question that's right at the nexus of the kind of research that I do in my capacity as a weather and climate scientist. I guess I'd say there's big picture certainties, but still important smaller scale uncertainties, with the acknowledgement that the big picture problem of climate change is now essentially a question of, you know, whether we're able to address the continued accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere through social and political means. That's sort of where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, at this point.
Daniel Swain, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation on In-Depth.
Thanks again for having me.
You can find this episode and past episodes of In-Depth online at kcbsradio.com. You can also hear In-Depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In-Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.